Welcome back to the 2152 project. Mike, how are we doing?
Fantastic. Thank you for having me again.
It's good to see you. Stash game still strong, man. Appreciate that.
We'll
That's
keep it for a little
legit.
bit longer.
Yeah,
We'll see when it
absolutely.
falls off.
Yep. Well, you had to start again. No Shave November is coming up pretty soon. So
It
again, this is the longest running series on the internet in terms of special education and work-based learning. And it's only because we took a year off. It was really designed to be a three-episode series with Melanie Allen and David Richardson, and now closing it out with Dr. Chelsea Morelli. So I'm going to read you a little bit from her bio. Dr. Chelsea Morelli is an assistant professor at the University of North Georgia, where her research and teaching focuses on preparing future educators to support students with autism and other exceptionalities. She earned her PhD from Georgia State University, where her dissertation explores the use of mixed reality simulation technology to increase pre-service teachers' behavior management skills. Dr. Morelli pulls from her personal experience as a special education teacher to provide evidence-based practices, technology-enhanced teacher training opportunities, and strategies for fostering inclusive learning environments to her pre-service teachers. Her work has been disseminated through peer-reviewed publications, national and international conferences, and innovative projects funded to advance teacher preparation. Impressive. Impressive, man. Now, obviously, disclaimer, I could only get someone with this much clout because she's my wife's cousin. So I don't so it is it's great to have you. Thank you for coming on, Dr. Morelli. How are you
Yeah,
doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for hyping me up.
Yeah, well, that's we are the hype machine. Like we are a hype machine, but really are glad to have you. And we're gonna pick up a theme again. Obviously delayed, we've talked about that, but pick up a theme on something that Mike and I are really passionate about, and it is special education and work-based learning. And so for those of you who maybe not remember, one of the topics that drove this was, Mike was going through. Mike, you tell the story. You reiterate the story about the transition plan and what really prompted us to start this series a year and a half ago.
Well, I mean, we utilized U-Science, our aptitude and interest assessments that we use for the students. And, as I was working with a student, I've been working with her and she wants to go into physical therapy and she's taken the classes. She's doing pretty good. We put her in a physical therapy internship and she does very well. They enjoyed her. They taught her. Everything was great. And I was invited to her transition meeting and as or the IEP meeting. And as I was there, I'm looking at this going, why is this not her plan? And as I looked at her plan was to try to go to college, work at a burger joint, and try to save some money. That was essentially the plan. And I just was like, this girl can do it. Why are these things not talking to each other? And so that just kind of prompted me just to look deep, dive deep. I found a lot of stuff that kind of concerned me. One of them is just a disconnect between what we do in work-based learning and what they do. And so it's one of those things. It's like, how do we come together and make sure that we're doing this? And as I show the results from her aptitude and interest, she has the skill set. There should have been no explanation as to why the burger joint and maybe doing some college and try to save some money was her plan. And it just as I was looking into all that, I just thought this is a problem. And as I started to go through, I started realizing that these plans aren't lining up with either their goals or what they're actually capable of doing. And the one thing I've learned is it's not people being lazy. That's for sure. Like it's not like they were just like, oh, let's just say put her at a burger joint. It was all of a sudden, there's this huge gap between just like, what do we do and what do they do? And how can we come together to make things work for the student? Take a little bit off the plate of their case managers and stuff like that. But it just, I mean, as I looked into it, I just became very concerned, but also encouraged because, it's like there's an answer. We can help. And so this
Yeah.
is how we can play together and get better outcomes for our students.
Yeah. And so that's driven this series. And it's why we wanted to bring on so our previous two guests David is someone who's just I mean, he's in a teacher in the trades, middle school trades. He's passionate about this. Melanie Allen, and do you remember her background? I can't remember offhand, but she is in special education, correct?
That is her background. And then at some point she was able to work in CTE, which is what work-based learning is housed under. That's career tech ed. And so then she was able to kind of see both sides, and that's when she started building that bridge. And so she's been instrumental in just helping me see the gaps, see the barriers, and where she's worked on both sides full time. It's just like she is years ahead of most people when it comes to bridging career tech ed, work-based learning, and our mild, mod, or even severe students as well.
And so that's kind of the goal of this is to have a conversation about, how can we work together? So, Chelsea, tell me a little bit about, I mean, what are your thoughts so far? I mean, you reviewed the previous two episodes. Maybe take a chance to time to introduce us to kind of what it is you do, your area, your specialty, and just your thoughts on someone in academia who is developing and shaping these future school counselors. Just give us a little bit of thought on what you're thinking, background, and I know you're particularly passionate about readiness and making transitions, bringing those earlier into that, which that is Mike's and I language. We're about exposing students to careers at a young age. So, what are your thoughts, reflections on that?
I was a special ed teacher for 5 years, and I decided to go back and, get into the higher ed world because I wanted to help prepare teachers for the classroom. I went through an extensive training program. I went to Valdosta State for my undergrad. I went to Vanderbilt for my master's degree. I was all, had all of this knowledge and then got into the classroom, and I struggled. And that happens to a lot of our teachers. So that's something that drove me to go back into higher ed. I think being in the classroom for those 5 years and, going from being trained to be a teacher and then actually being a teacher, changed my perspective a lot. Teacher prep programs, they teach by the book, and this is how you write an IEP goal. Kids need to know these letters. They need to be taught this phonic sound. They need to do this, this, and this. Well, I went into the classroom, and one of my parents said, "Oh, my kid can read. Oh, you think that my kid will actually have the potential to read?" And that was, to me, I went, "Well, yeah, every kid needs to learn how to read." And then I thought to myself, you know what? Like, who said? I mean, yeah, you need reading to, function in everyday life, but like, how deep do I need to really go with this child to be able to read? What is this child's ultimate goal? What do their parents want them to be able to do? What will make this kid a successful part of their community? At the end of the day, that's what parents want for their kids with disabilities. And that's what that mom brought to my attention was I was so focused on they need to add, they need to know their letters, they need to know how to read, they need to be able to do this, this, and that. And then I thought to myself, who said they need to be able to do that in order to be successful? And so when I was telling you guys earlier, part of my service, part of my life, where I kind of get to still be in part of, the disability world, and it counts, towards part of what I do, is I work with individuals with disabilities on and tennis activities. And so talking to their parents, what they want their kid to be is they just want their child to be a successful part of the community, someone who is giving to their community and giving back, right? So whether that's having a job, living on their own, whatever level it is, that's what they want their kids to do. And so getting that perspective, taking what I learned into the classroom, I bring that into what I do now, which I am an assistant professor of special education. I am working in a program that's dual cert, so our students will come out certified to teach gen ed or special ed. And so now I try to bring that perspective of, it doesn't have to be check the boxes of learn your sight words, teaching phonics. Those don't have to be the goals. We need to think broader. We need to understand what is it that's going to make this child successful. For gen ed students, it might be going to college. It might be reading on grade level. It might be this, this, and this. But for my kids and my classroom, success might look different for them. And so I try to bring that perspective to my current students who are pre-service teachers. I know that gets confusing when I start throwing students around because I mean
I
it
got
both
you.
ways.
Two
We've
different
got
ways,
our
yep.
little kid students, but then my current students are pre-service teachers, so they're college age. And so I try to bring that perspective to them. And I also really, really push, my students, my pre-service teachers, they are going to be pre-K through five, most of them that I work with. And so I try to tell them, you've got to start the transition process from day one. You need to
Okay.
start talking to parents about that from the beginning. What is your goal? And those goals may change as your kid grows.
Yeah,
But
absolutely.
what does success look like to you? Is it going to a Clemson Life program? Is it getting a job? Is it living independently? And what can we start now to build that foundation? Talking to one of my parents recently, her son went to the Clemson Life program and they started preparing and working on that in fifth grade to get him into the Clemson Life program. They started from, and it was because one of their friends, one of their child's teachers had told them about the program. And so that was the goal they set in fifth grade. How many fifth graders do you know are thinking about college and their parents? Not many.
And so that is super encouraging to know that that's happening, because I know that Mike and I have a lot of conversations. He's one of my best buddies, and he probably gets a lot of late night random text. Well, it's not late night for you because you live in Utah. So late night
Yeah,
for
it's
me is like di
always.
it's like dinner time for you. So maybe I'm giving you too much credit, but he gets a lot of late night text from me, either complaining about something or just saying, I'm so frustrated at, why don't people value careers more? Or, I mean, just so many of those conversations. It's so encouraging to hear that in a non-CTE area, career tech area, that people are putting emphasis on careers. That's exciting. That's heartwarming. And so what would you say, Chelsea? What is like how does that happen? What do you what's a common outcome for students who are served? And I know there's a lot of different levels inside of special education, but what's a common outcome for students? Is the goal, obviously, if the student is not someone who's going to be able to college, what is a good appropriate goal for that student? And then how can work-based learning, which is very similar to programs across the state and country, CTI, vocational rehab, those programs that serve students with special needs, how can work-based learning come in and help establish or help facilitate those goals, the earlier conversations you have? What do you think on and thoughts on that?
I think, the common goal, which I mentioned earlier, is finding the way that a child can be successful and be a contributing factor in their community. And that can look different, depending on the levels. I've worked with individuals who could go off to Clemson Life or I can't think of the other names. That's the first one that popped into my head. So I've said it like three times now, but go off to a program like that and, get a job. Part-time working in a hotel or doing something like that. But then I've also worked with individuals who that's not an option, where they're not going to get to that. But I think starting it young, I think the way that work-based learning could tie into that, honestly, is, through communication, and starting those conversations early off. We're not making on my end, and by my end, I mean the elementary end. We're not making life-altering decisions, from day one, but we're opening those lines of communication, saying, hey, parents, here's a wide variety of options. You could go to a Clemson Life, or you could, your child could be at working, at stocking shelves at a grocery store, whatever the option is, and neither one of those is better than the other, to be completely honest with you. It just depends on the student and the child and, what's the best fit for them. And I think, not necessarily setting like that firm goal from day one, because again, it can change over time. We know kids change every day and, they change in different ways. I think I heard him say something last time that I loved. You throw the seeds on the ground and the flowers, they all grow eventually, unless I'm the one that threw them on the ground. They don't tend to grow,
Not a
but
green thumb over here either.
metaphorically, they all grow. They grow at different times, right? So I think keeping those broad goals and conversations, and I think the way you If it were a perfect ideal world, we would have work-based learning representatives sitting at the IEP table with us.
Oh, love that.
Maybe not, leading the charge of the meeting in elementary school, but giving us some tidbits of things to think about,
Mike, man, you know me well. We're talking about broad stroke conversations. We're talking about exposure. We're talking about learning possibilities, having these discussions. Man, you know what I'm thinking about, don't you? You science. And it's a theme of every one of our look, I promise people we're not paid by U Science. I promise you that. I just love it. I mean, it's such a cool program. And as I'm hearing Dr. Morelli talk about, having these conversations at a younger and younger level, that brings in the spectrum of work-based learning. Yes, Mike and I primarily deal with work-based learning in the experience level. We're pushing students in the workplace and seeing them work. But when you come back down, that's typically, Mike, and correct me if I'm wrong, for in Georgia, it's basically 10th grade through 12th grade is that experience level where we're putting them to work once they're 16 or older. But in the 6th to 9th grade level, that is that exploration model where they're exploring these careers. But before that, in the area that Dr. Morelli's talking about, is that exposure model. Because if you expose them at a young age, whether regular ed or special ed, let them see the options that are available, then they have careers they're interested in to explore at the middle school level to then narrow the scope a little bit more to say, okay, I want to try this in the experience or the high school level. So what are your thoughts on this, Mike? What are you hearing so far?
Oh man. I mean, I love what I'm hearing, and I'm actually listening as a view as a listener, because I'm trying to find a solution here as well. And last week I was sitting in a transition meeting and I said, "Can I ask a question? Why are all the students doing the same job shadows? Why am I getting the same students from you semester after semester in the same field?" And they said, "Well, that's what they're interested in." I said, "Is that what they're interested in, or is that just what they saw their friends do before?" And I said, "Look, we work with businesses, like almost 1,000 different businesses. Our career clusters for the state, there's like what, like 12 or 13 career clusters that lead to, hundreds of different jobs." And yet it just seems like, why is it that every time I have a student that's in special education, they're interested in the same three jobs? And as we got talking, they said, "Well, what are you recommending?" I said, "We've got to get to these students a little bit sooner." And they said, "Well, what does that look like?" And I said, "Well, obviously kindergarten through 12th grade, this should be a process. But the research I had done a couple of years ago is, at least in our district, a student could make it all the way to fifth grade and only be exposed to 4 to 6 of the 12 plus clusters." I mean, the clusters kind of change every year, but I know there's at least 12, maybe 13 or 14 this year, who knows? But they'll get all the way to fifth grade without even being exposed to all the different clusters, let alone the pathways inside of those clusters. And so then, and here's the thing, this is why I felt comfortable saying this in that room, is that these guys, they were not, trying to be lazy. They weren't trying to take shortcuts, but they said, "Mike, we would love to be able to help these students get more exposure. But when you have a student having a seizure on the hour every hour, and you're also supposed to be the one that goes out there and finds these employers, then you have to make a decision between helping the student through a seizure while also maintaining a class, or increasing their clusters." And what he was saying is, "We love what you're saying, but I don't think you understand the barriers that we face every 50 minutes in our classroom." And I said, "Well, would you turn down my help?" And he says, "Absolutely not. I would love for you to help us." And so we're setting a meeting because we've had these conversations in the past, but no one's ever really been that frank, like saying, "You couldn't go talk to 1,000 employers. You couldn't expand their clusters. If you have, 25 students and one's having a seizure every hour, and these other students have their own, their own stuff that we have to worry about." And he says, "How are we going to fix this problem?" And that's why I was listening. I was really hoping that Dr. Morelli was going to give me the pill that I could feed all of us and we all fix the problem overnight.
Yeah.
But what are your thoughts? Like, what does that look like when we are like the teachers are willing, but their bandwidth is full? How do we, what does that look like? Like, what can we take back and start applying next week? You know, to start this, you know, fixing this problem.
Yeah, I mean that's a it's this is something I really wanted to talk about today too, is like we are facing a crisis in special ed right now. We cannot get enough able bodies in the classroom to work with these individuals. It is just it is not the place, it's not the hopping job place to be where people want to go. They just, you know, we can't get people to want to teach special education. I don't understand why I was born for this, so I don't understand it. But it is something that we are really struggling with, is one, getting people in the classroom, getting people who are willing and certified and have the skills to teach special education and to keep them in the classroom. There are statistics out there that, I mean, there are very few teachers out there who have been in the special education classroom longer than 5 years, and I am guilty. I am one of them. I left after 5 years, to pursue this further passion. But one, just getting people to go in the classroom, and then two, to be able to do all the things at the same time. You know, it's something like teaching special education is like a job of many, many hats. There's this image that I show my students, and it's a little person, and they've got like 70 hats, and they all have labels on them of all the things that special education teachers are supposed to do. I've done things like I've had students with seizures disorders in my classroom. I've had students with catheters. I've been almost a full-time nurse. I've changed students' catheters in my class, not in my classroom, but you know, we've there's so many things that special education teachers are have to do. There's so many things that we want to do too. We would love. I don't think if you went to a single special education teacher and asked them, like, hey, do you want to help get your students ready for a career and a successful life, that they would say no. I don't think they would.
Exactly.
You know,
I agree 100%.
yeah,
You
it's
know. So what
I.
does it look like though, Chelsea? So recommendations, one, how can we collaborate better with, you know, from a career tech special a career tech area, and then the capstone for a career tech being work-based learning, how can we as a group better partner with special education? And then two-part question, how is that help perceived? And I know you can't, and that's a blanket statement because some people are going to be like, I don't need your help, I'm good. But it sounds like you're saying that the consensus would be, oh no, we have 1,000 other things to do, and this is important, but it's not more important than the kid who I have to monitor for seizures. So, how can we be better collaborators across that seemingly massive chasm of career tech ed and special ed? How can we do that to help students transition into viable careers? You know, like I said, not just the low-hanging fruit of fast food, but viable careers. What can we do there? How can we be better collaborators?
Yeah, first thing that came to mind was exposure. Exposure to the issue and to the resources and supports that are out there. And I always imagine it being like a pyramid, like a trickle-down effect. So if you start with, you know, where teachers are getting trained, so with us in higher ed, and start with the communication and exposure to the pre-service teachers. This is a problem. This is, you know, and now I'm going to go just down like 18 rabbit holes at one time, but you know, showing the pre-service teachers, this is where it is. Where are you really trying to get your students to go? And I was fortunate enough to have parents who just shot it real straight with me when I was in my first few years of teaching. Like, I'm not worried about my kid learning how to read a chapter book. And I was like,
Yeah.
oh,
Okay.
you're not? Oh,
Okay.
okay. You know, so changing that perspective of teachers, of, you know, what is the ultimate goal here? It's to get these students into their community. It's to get them to be successful contributors to the community. How do we get there? And I
Yeah.
think by one, creating that exposure to pre-service teachers, to people that are at higher up in school districts so that they can see, oh, this is an option. This is a great way that we could, improve the outcome for all of our students. Not, it's also, a challenge because in a perfect world, we would have all the funding and all the support we could,
Were
to
you, yeah.
provide this. Unfortunately, I can't remember the percentage off the top of my head, but the percentage of students who are served on an IEP in public schools is so significantly smaller than the general population. It's growing by a lot, but it's still such a small population that we don't get the su sufficient amount of funding that we wish we could have.
So what do you think would be like, I mean, and it may be a little bit different for you working with, training teachers to go into, pre-K through five, special ed, but what would be the biggest need for us? So in that exposure area, is it going in and maybe volunteering to teach a little mini lesson to some of these classes? Mike, I'm thinking immediately back to that thing that you and I are so passionate about that we don't get to do very often is the My First Resume activity. And you're going back and doing that. Is it volunteering to sit on some of these transition or these IEP meetings? And I guess my concern with this is, I don't want to overstep. I want to volunteer to be a part of this and to help and to tell our special ed director, hey, look, I have access to U-Science at the high school level. I can go in and pull these reports and I can show you exactly what the kids' interests and aptitudes are and show you exactly what would be some good plans for the student in a transition. So where do you think we would best fit? Is it in the going in and sharing instruction? Is it helping develop the goals and plans for that student to transition into work? Or is it yes, everything?
Yeah, oh, I think it's everything. I think hitting it from both sides of the teacher prep side, so you're hitting that next generation of teachers that are coming in to, start the new wave of hey, this is something we really should be thinking about. I think, volunteering to come in on transition meetings is great, but it starts even before then,
Before
all the
that.
way back to the elementary school. And something you were talking about earlier that I wrote myself a note, and I don't know if it ties here or not, but I'm gonna say it, is you may not be able to identify, and I don't think the goal should be to identify an outcome for a K through five student. That's getting that tunnel vision that I think we're trying to
Absolutely.
avoid is tunnel vision. But if there was a way to identify some broader skills to give, I would have loved for someone to come to me as a kindergarten through fifth grade special ed teacher and say, hey, this student with autism, yeah, you want to work with his, maybe you need some social skills, some social goals, but you know what? This kid, why are we trying to change this kid to meet the world? Why don't we change the world to meet this kid? Maybe coding, maybe sitting, maybe they don't need to socialize. They don't need to be a social butterfly. And maybe they feel comfortable sitting behind a computer screen, and cybersecurity is where they need to go, and so I don't necessarily think,
Absolutely.
we don't want to get that tunnel vision, but if someone had told me from day one, like, hey, you know what? Here's these career options that really meet students who might generally look like this. Focus on typing, focus on some basic like skills that could lead them to a better career path instead of me trying to get this kid to look someone in the eye and greet them 3 times a day. Maybe I could work on, typing or coding. I've worked
And
on
that would be such a good thing because, like you mentioned, one of the main things that Mike and I do is teach those employability skills. We don't call them soft skills, Dr. Morelli. We don't call them soft skills because they're not soft, they're hard to find, to teach, to get. We call them employability skills, durable skills, a lot of other things. But that's a great idea. It's having in to come in and teach the handshaking. Maybe do, you know, maybe a, maybe Mike, I'm thinking like a version of a reverse career fair, that we do. And so I'm going to add that just a little bit here, and I'm going to show you. I mentioned this activity that Mike and I, so I'm going to share my screen real quick, and that may be a little awkward for the people who are consuming this on audio. So we would encourage you to go look at it on YouTube if you want. But I'm going to share this activity. This is an activity that Mike and I, I kind of had the idea, and Mike helped me collaborate. It's called My First Resume. Can you see that? So look, Chelsea, you know me. I am not artsy-fartsy. I'm not cutesy.
It's
I'm
so
not an
colorful.
elementary. I'm proud of it. I am a graphic designer, but it's hard for me to get out of the polished space. But anyway, so we built this activity to be something along the lines of, go into a first grade class and ask them questions that they would just know. Like not it, it's when you go in, you tell a kid, hey, we're gonna build a resume. They're like, I don't know about that, whatever. But you go into a first grade class and you just ask them to put their name down. You print this off and you give them crayons, and it's like, hey, what are some things that you do well? Well, how does that translate to a resume for an adult student or an adult person? Is these are your skills, right? And what do you do well? Those are your skills. Things I like translate to an adult resume is interests, aptitudes, right? And then who can say nice things about me? That's the references part of your resume, right? Mom, dad, my teachers, my this. And then we came to the next page and it was like, when I grew up, the things I want to do for work, or the things I want to do for work, and they would draw a picture, right? They would draw a picture. So some of them would draw, and I put some pizza down here. They would, they want to be, at that age, they're typically wanting to go in and do like police or teacher or the things they see every day, right? And so they would say, this is what I want to be when I grow up, and then why I want to be a teacher, or why I want to be, it could be, I want to be a teacher because I want to help people like Dr. Morelli does, or I want to be a policeman so I can keep people safe. And then why would you be a good X or Y or Z, whatever they said. And so my plan was to build this out throughout elementary school, and then when they get to middle school, tie this into their U Science results. And so that's the just a real quick detour from what we were talking about into that is that I think that kind of summarizes a way we could get involved on all those levels. Come in, show them here. This is an exposure element. Maybe teach them how to shake hands and talk and look at people and have those conversations and look them in the eye. And then, that would obviously be a little bit later as they're getting into, maybe you bring in some other teachers or some policemen and you have them do that little, small scale career fair where they talk to the people. And I'm getting excited about this kind of stuff. This is such a good conversation.
I mean,
Mike, thoughts? Chelsea, thoughts?
I was going to say, why can't that little paper sit in an IEP folder
Should.
for teachers? When the folder gets passed off, just look at it and go, oh, okay, they're interested in this. That's good to know. And then
Okay.
as they get older, that form changes into, the aptitude test results. And that's in there. And that's in mind whether you guys can sit at the table or not, because there's only two of you. And I
Yeah.
imagine in a bigger districts, there may be one or two people who are, in this work-based learning, but why can't that document live in something similar like that, live in an IEP folder?
Yeah. What you got, Mike?
100%. I mean, I love it because, a barrier that we have is, U Science, we started in sixth grade, and I see its value at that age. Where I feel like if our teachers in the special education realm, if you look at the aptitudes and interests of the students, what I've noticed is, the aptitudes are what they're naturally good at, but they might not know or be interested in it. But if you find a student who's like, that's their interested, they're hyper focused, some of my students, they get so hyper focused on something that they become an expert. It's all that they can talk about. And so what I've just encouraged is, let's use those results and use those to figure out which employers we bring in for that intermediate middle school age. But let's also take time to have the students who are hyper focused, where they can share all that they've learned to a student who has the aptitudes. And so they can kind of learn what this is all about. And that's an activity where the teacher is letting the student communicate with the student. They're teaching them about this, about this pathway, this career. I think there's value in it. And I realized that maybe what Dr. Morelli said is that my approach might have been wrong when I was, researching the K-5 realm. I was so concerned that they weren't getting exposed to all of the clusters that she nailed it. The easiest thing and the most impactful thing is exposed to the right skills. If we can give them the skills, because my first resume, a student could say, something I'm good at is giving hugs. I think that was actually one of your students, Jason,
Yeah,
that
that
wrote that on their
was.
resume, was giving
Yeah.
hugs
Yeah, they did.
and helping others. Well, what career pathways do we know that caring for others is a required skill? And I can think of many. And so taking those skills that they do have and using that to expose their strengths to opportunities is going to give them confidence that is completely, I think, has so much more value than just saying, were they exposed to all of the clusters this year? Who cares? How about we build the right skills for their and show them what they can do, and the confidence that they'll gain from that, I think, could just be through the roof in terms of what it generates for their personal growth.
And what a great way to translate, a first grader says, "I'm good at giving hugs." And then the professional says, "Well, that, what that means is you would probably really like careers that serve other people." Maybe it's a teacher, maybe it's a nurse, maybe it's a social worker, maybe it's a, or I love, I'm good at taking my dog for a walk. And it's like, well, have you ever thought about being a vet or a vet tech or a vet assistant? Like, I mean, so what a good way to translate back into those. Man, I'm excited, and I feel like I haven't gotten to any of the other rest of my questions, but I wouldn't change it. The content, so rich here. I will say this. I want to go back to what you said, Dr. Morelli, is you, like, from the time you started talking, you've talked about a customized approach. And that to me is something that anyone who knows me, who's listened to me speak or on this podcast or read anything that I've written, it's specifically about destroying the one size fits all approach to post-secondary training. I hate it. I hate when you, when there is an agenda and you push kids one way or the other. I'm not anti-academia. I've spent my life going to school. I'm anti one size fits all approach. I'm anti push everybody this way, because if you push, if that's the goal, if the goal is to say, and this is what's so, and this is what I think that David talked about a lot in his episode, is if the goal has become college, and since the goal has become college, the students who are not going to be able to go to college, they're disqualified from the start. The students who you're talking about, who are, it's going to be an accomplishment for them to be able to read a chapter book. College may not be in the cards for that person, but if that's the goal that our educational system is set up, man, there's no way for them to succeed. So I guess my question would be, how do we change the narrative? Because one of the reasons, again, I love YouScience is because it gives me data to celebrate a student, no matter where they're at on the spectrum of regular ed, gifted ed, special ed. How, Dr. Miller, how can we as practitioners, how can we better celebrate students who are in the special education program when all they hear is, we have to change this so you can do better, or we have to modify, or we have to accommodate, or we have to make, like, how can we change the language there? Is there an established practice? If not, then there's your next research paper. Like, how do we change the language to be able to celebrate kids who are in special education without them hearing all of the modify, accommodate, change, because that's what we hear, but what they really are saying is, I would assume they're hearing is, man, I'm not good enough to do what my peers are doing. I can't, versus coming in here and saying, you sign 1,000 me and tell a kid, hey, but I don't care about any of that stuff. You are good at this. You are good at this. I don't care what your grades are like. I don't care what your IEP says. You can do this. How do we change that language?
Yeah, I think it's got to be a perspective switch. And I it's funny you say that. I'm sitting here thinking, I wonder how many special education teachers are like, oh, yeah, my kid can't, I'm thinking back to, okay, when I taught in special education, my students had to take the statewide assessment. And we know that teachers' performance is tied to that, but like not really at the same time. So I was a teacher of the year for my school one year. And part of the teacher of the year for the district was to highlight that my students had made improvements. How do I encompass that? My encompassment of my students making improvement is vastly different than a gen ed teacher. They can whip out those test scores, they can show the graphs and everything. You know what? My kids sat down and took the assessment. They sat down and we didn't have a meltdown. How do I encompass that? How do I show that, right? So
How
I
do you elevate it to the same level as my kid came in and grew two grade levels of reading in one semester, and you're saying my kid didn't pitch a fit during a test? I can imagine.
I know I kick myself thinking to myself, like, it didn't really matter that they sat down anyways, right? But, the level of success is, we've set this level that this is success. And again, I've thought about this all night last night. It's like the chicken and the egg argument. Which came first? Did we model the education system off of the private sector, the labor of, this is the skills you need to do to get here? Or did the work come first and the chicken came later of the education system? I've gotten myself in this conundrum of, well, are we trying to match education to better fit the workplace, or is the workplace doing what it's doing because of the education system and the way it's set up? So, how do we best celebrate is the perspective that we're giving. And I think that comes all the way back to, what are the goals that we're setting for the students? What does success actually look like? It can't be a one size fits all. And I think there's baby steps to it. I think it's got to grow a lot more. I think too, I'm sure everyone listening probably has something similar in their community where there's, we just opened one here where I live, a cafe that is strategically built to employ individuals with disabilities. That is a huge celebration in our community. We're all very excited about it. Everyone's very excited to go and support their business, support the individuals. But how does that translate back into the education system? They're getting celebrated in the community here, but like, have they been celebrated their entire life of being able to reach the goals that it took for them to be able to work in that situation? Coming to school and sitting in a desk, was that celebrated that they could do that? Thinking back to my experience of, like, were my students celebrated because they actually logged into their computer and they didn't throw it across the room when I told them it was statewide testing day? No, they weren't. They weren't celebrated for that. Were the gen ed students celebrated because they made improvements in two grade levels? Absolutely.
And so, but I mean, but so I think I'm glad. So it seems like my question, you're affirming it, is that, I wonder, work-based learning, especially in tools, like I said, the tool I use with U-Science, it allows me to go in and tell a kid, hey, look, I know you've had accommodations and modifications, and you've been told your whole life that things had to be changed for you to be successful, right? Because, and I know that's not what we're saying, but that's what they're hearing, is we have to change the norm for you to be successful. Work-based learning is completely different. Like, work-based learning is, I have employers who don't care about IEPs. They're like, can they do the job? And work-based learning allows us to celebrate those kids. And so going into the elementary level, having, a plan to come out and to put students on a path and a track, track's not the right word, to expose them to careers that allows them to move in a direction of interest and aptitude, it ushers those outcomes to into reality where we can actually celebrate them. Mike, where are you at?
I am just grateful, honestly, for this discussion that it's even happening. I'm a firm believer that the employer is the customer, not the student. I think what you said, though, is very correct, that the employer has no legal obligation to match the IEP that's given at the academic level.
That's my next
And
question.
as you were saying that, it clicked that shouldn't be a question asked if we started younger, because as they're gaining the skills and being exposed to opportunities and gaining interest and then being exposed to opportunities and then being gained, by the time they get to that point, IEP or not, they're going to be ready. And I have students that will pivot who don't have any, IEPs. They'll pivot last minute and try a different career, and it's an absolute failure. Not because, they couldn't do it. It's because they didn't have enough exposure time in advance to really prepare for that moment. I think the key thing is that the students have to be able to visualize themselves being successful in it. And once they believe in themselves, then the employers were should, because I've had employers do the same thing. They've said to me, well, do I have to accommodate, or what about this? And they're all concerned. And our state specialist said something. She said, if you spend all of your time at the high school level, catching kids up on their careers, then you have a very poor work-based learning program. She said the 11th and 12th grade year should be a stepping stone where they've all this prep work. Now it's time to step into those opportunities. But we spend so much time catching them up on exposure. And it when you said that, I just thought, man, I couldn't imagine if the girl that can give hugs was exposed to all of the pathways in that, and she had all this confidence. And we're not pigeonholing her, because there's so many pathways that compassion, empathy, and other things are valuable. And she took that, and then when she gets into the youth science assessment, and it kind of confirms and grows more, we're adding her strengths with all of these exposure opportunities. We're now looking at aptitudes. We're adding more. I mean, by the time they get to 12th grade, an employer should never have to say, do I have to match the IEP? I mean, this I think that a lot of our students just need that confidence, and they'll do it. Like, they'll get the job done. But anyways, that's just a tangent, but I was just grateful, for what you got. I was just listening to you just with gratitude. I'm like, man, you guys are awesome, both of you. And I am enjoying every second of this. And I look forward to just kind of applying some of the thoughts I've had today with what we're doing, so we can strengthen and do a better job at the K-12 realm.
Well, I've got one more question, and then Dr. Murray, they will let you kind of, close us out with any closing thoughts, and maybe Mike has another question or not. But Mike hit on it, and this to me is the most pressing issue, and I really think that this is something that needs to be researched and that needs to be documented. And again, Mike hit on it when he said the private sector is under no obligation to follow IEPs and 504s. Now, I know IEPs are
I thought they
rooted
do have to do a 504, but not
504
IEP.
only if it's rooted and established in ADA, right?
Okay.
And then 50 and then IEPs and IDEA. So and that's what I'm saying. So the point is there's so even if I'm wrong and you're right there, Mike, the point is not right or wrong. The point is there is confusion on the topic. And so when I go to an employer and I say, hey, here's a student, one, Dr. Morelli, I can't disclose a student's accommodations. The student, so we're forcing. So there's two issues. We're forcing a 16 to 18-year-old student to self-advocate, which is good, but that's a massive responsibility for a 16 or 17-year-old to juxtapose these two decisions. Do I self-disclose my accommodations, modifications, and risk not getting the job? Because again, the private sector is under no obligation to hire me. Or do I not disclose my accommodations and modifications to get the job, but then know that my performance is going to be affected because my employer doesn't know I need these accommodations? That's a tough thing to do. And so I guess I mean, can you give us in practitioners and work-based learning any advice on that? Because the private sector can just say, and I guess here's my example. My first year here, I had a student who had Crohn's disease, and she got a job at a call center, right? So this is more of a 504 than an IEP issue. And 504s may not be in your area, so I'm not presupposing they are, but the issue, this is what made me think of this. She could not, she was taking a lot of bathroom breaks, which is a manifestation of that disorder or that disease. And her employer let her go. And it was like, hey, that's when I realized, man, they're under no obligation to follow these public sector compliance issues with IEPs and 504s. And so the question is, should the student have disclosed that she had Crohn's disease so that he knew and maybe wouldn't have put her at a desk at a call center, maybe give her another option, but risk not getting the job? Or does she disclose it or not disclose it and then not do well in the job? Does that make sense? That's what made this, that's what opened this up to me. And so as a professional, as an expert in special education, are there any thoughts? That'll be my last question for today, and then I'll let you and Mike close this out. Any thoughts on that, Dr. Morelli?
That sounds like a terribly unfortunate situation. I am a huge advocate for self-advocating. As silly as
I
that
like
sounds.
it. Yeah.
I tell my students from the start, we need to, from day one, you need to have your students start advocating for themselves, start learning what they need to be successful and how to ask for that, make that request, how to be able to control their environment in order to set themselves up for success. It's something that we do. Everyone does it. I know, for example, right now, I am controlling this environment. I have a one-year-old who is getting ready for a nap, but I am controlling this environment by having, her be put down for a nap, right? I am advocating for myself so that I can be successful in this environment. And so I try to bring that perspective to my pre-service teachers. They're not aware that they do it themselves. Some of my students do have accommodations and modifications that they get through the student success office, and they bring those to me. But there's other students that they're not aware that they're advocating for themselves and that they're doing it by saying, "Hey, Dr. Morelli, I've got to take my kid to a doctor's appointment, or I'm not feeling well today. Can you send me this? Can you do me that?" That's advocating, and they don't realize they're doing it. And so I try to bring that to their attention so that they can start working with their young students on advocating for themselves. You've got a student who is having a hard time sitting for long periods of time. This is a terrible example. I'm going to just preface that this is a terrible example. I am
Understand.
not a supporter of sitting all day long, okay? But there are times when students have to sit. We can't avoid that, right? But I'm going to continue with the bad example anyways. But if you have a student who has a hard time sitting for long periods of time, teach them to advocate for themselves, to ask for a break. Ask for, "Hey, can I sit in this chair instead of that chair? Hey, I find this student distracting to me, or I find the computer distracting to me. While I do my work, can I sit over here? Can I sit in an isolation desk so that I can get this done?" And it's simple things like that, to teach them from a young age to start advocating for themselves so that when they get older, they can decide, "Am I able to be successful in this situation without X, Y, and Z? Or will X, Y, and Z help me be successful
That's so
here?"
good. That's so good.
And it starts with small things from a young age. I'm feeling overwhelmed, overstimulated, and making sure that they're aware of those situations. So I tend to work with students with autism. And so I try to, when I was a teacher, I tried to make them aware of, "Hey, it's loud in here. I can see your shoulders are tensing up. This is the start of feeling overwhelmed. Are you beginning to feel overwhelmed? You are. Okay, let's talk through it. What can you ask for in this situation to help you calm down?"
Yeah. How do you feel now? And when you feel this way, that's when you ask for, man, that's so good, Dr.
Before we
Morelli.
get to that. And those are small things that we can do on the front end. And so I try to bring that awareness to my pre-service teachers. That's where like my behavior comes in, and I talk to people about it. It's funny. I'm like, I'd work with behavior, but like I don't at the same time. We're trying to avoid the behaviors. We're trying to figure out how can we communicate those feelings beforehand. And so that's something that I talk with my pre-service teachers about a lot is, what does advocating look like at a young age, and what does it look like to a high schooler, to someone who's going into the workforce? What does that look like, and how do we work backwards from there, if that makes sense? Now,
That's perfect.
yeah, so that's kind of my stance on it. I love advocating. I love teaching those skills. I love bringing awareness to my students because a lot of them haven't had exposure Or they have, and they didn't realize that they've had exposure to those advocating situations and things like that.
Awesome. All right, Mike.
I
So here's
missed
what I got.
questions. Sorry, I think I missed
No, that's
half of
perfect.
the
That was great.
question.
That was
Okay, okay.
perfect. Themes from this episode. Transition awareness earlier. Okay, Dr. Maria hit on that. Exposure to careers earlier. Collaboration and follow through from special ed and CTE and work-based learning. And then Dr. Maria just hit on self-advocacy. Like that is something that we should be teaching students how to do. Consciously helping our students who have IEPs learn how to advocate at an earlier and earlier level, learn how to have those conversations, which is tough with students who are in a social media generation and they're not used to having face-to-face contact. So those are
Yeah.
the themes I picked up, Mike. Thoughts, reflections, and then take us home.
I really don't want to ruin a good thing you guys have going. I mean, it's been fun to be get a front row seat here. The only thing that I know that I'm always looking for, in addition to those things, is a resource. And so an RTA, a resource takeaway, one of my favorite resources I learned years ago, and it's a huge system, so it's hard to find stuff sometimes, but it's called it's askjan.org, and it's for disability students. And so on askjan.org, you can go in there and find anything. And so if a student is doing an interview, and let's say they do have a physical ailment that wasn't brought up in the interview, they can actually leave them with a letter at the end saying, "You may have noticed my arm. I was born this way, and this is how I overcome it, and this is how I can still get the job done effectively." And so it removes the barrier of, it lets them just interview, but then it also says, "Look, I've had this issue my whole life, and this is how I get over it." And so, but so Dr. Morelli, are there resources that you would love to that are available to the public that we could use, that we could look over, that would be beneficial moving forward?
There's tons of things out there to use for that. Something that came to mind when you were talking about ashjan.org is, in higher ed, AI is a little bit of a touchy topic, but
Yeah.
getting a
I love it.
script or something like that to help students see what that conversation can look like, see what that use as an advocating tool. Honestly, you've just made me think of that, where I was like, you know what, that would be a great activity to have my students, work through. Imagine you're going, you've got a student who has, this disability. How would you teach them to communicate it, and have them come up with a script, use AI to come up with a script to help you with that? But yeah, there's tons of resources out there that are really helpful for that. I don't have any that come to mind, but specifically,
Well, I
but
know that with that, what you just mentioned is I presented on this in Seattle last year. It's actually a resource bonus content on the podcast. It was AI and apprenticeship, and I went in and used a platform called schoolai.com
yeah,
to
that's a good one.
build a mock interview bot. So my students can go into this space, tell them I want a general interview, which is going to ask them questions about employability skills, or I want an interview me for an entry-level position at a finance firm or as a CNA coming into a hospital. And then AI generates that, and they have to have conversations and they have to have dialogue and they have to go through that. So why could we not? That's a great idea. Why could we not pivot that and make it a self-advocacy? I will be doing that later today. I will be copying, duplicating that, and then changing the script so it is, teach the student how to self-advocate. Love that idea.
And something that, may not be as publicly used, but something that you guys might want to think about is, I use simulator technology to have my pre-service teachers practice delivering challenging news to parents. Have them talk about review IEP goals. Have them talk with a one of my colleagues uses a simulation technology to have Pre-service teachers practice working with a reluctant co-teacher, someone who's not really into it, and they have to have that awkward conversation.
Yeah, that's good.
Using stimulation technology to practice interviews, practice advocating for themselves in an interview situation. Those are things that, maybe you guys might want to look into. Call me, I'll come and help. Or I will virtually come and help. That's the great tool thing about it is, I can use it from, across the state to across the country. I can put my pre-service teachers through the simulator and I can see them practice. And the great part about it is if they mess up, it's all good. We just press the restart button.
Press
So,
the reset button,
yeah,
huh?
your students who are working, getting prepared for interviews, getting prepared to talk about, I need this accommodation. They can practice having that conversation in a safe space, and you can sit there and listen, and you can provide them with feedback and have them try it again. And yeah, so that's another great option you guys could think about eventually.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Morelli. That's all I've got. And in reflecting on this, so grateful for your time. Grateful for having to be able to tackle a tough topic, a topic that people are probably scared to ask some questions about because they don't want to, pigeonhole or and that's the thing is that, special education is not something we can't talk about. We should talk about. We should include. We should look at how we can serve these students. The same way as we do our other students who are best learning. So, anything else, Mike? You
That's it.
good?
You guys are fantastic.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for tuning in to the episode of 2152 Project. But thank you again for tuning in. As always, you can find us on whatever podcast platform you prefer and YouTube at 2152 Project. Y'all have a great day.